Chapter 9. The Sex Imperatives. In their book, Magnificent Sex, Peggy Kleinplatz and A. Dana Maynard describe their interviews with people of many sexual orientations, gender identities, and ages, kinky and vanilla, a monogamous, or in open relationships, who had one thing in common. They self-identified as having extraordinary sex lives. In the interviews, researchers inquired not just about what extraordinary sex was like, but also how each person found their way to the experience. Answer? First, unlearning, meaning unlearning much of what they previously thought they knew about sex and sexuality, including negative, destructive, or simply constricting messages. The second answer was letting go and overcoming, meaning they had to deconstruct and overcome the restrictive ideas about sex and themselves that had become embedded in their minds. These negative messages and restrictive ideas are the lies I talked about in Chapter 5. They're false beliefs that might make sexual difficulties feel urgent and high stakes, as if you have so much to lose if you don't fix your sex life. These messages can also make the tools and mindsets I've described so far feel out of reach or impossible to apply. Crucially, every participant who had experienced these negative influences, and nearly all participants had, overcame them and went on to become a person who had magnificent sex. You can too. In this chapter, I want to discuss what some of those negative or limiting ideas might be, along with two important strategies for unearthing these weeds to get them out of your erotic gardens for good. The Sex Imperatives. In Chapter 1, I mentioned a queer Gen X woman who felt that her need to be desired stemmed from a part of her that was convinced she was unfuckable. This, despite the fact that she was actually doing a lot of fucking at the time. Why couldn't all that fucking convince this part of her that she was fuckable? She said, "The feeling of unfuckability is not about fucking at all. It's actually about cultural validation. It's about feeling seen and valued as a sex object, seeing yourself reflected in the culture as a sex object. There was nobody that looked like me in movies or TV being portrayed as fuckable. So it didn't matter who I fucked because I was confusing actual fucking for cultural validation." "When I talk to other people," I replied, "sometimes they connect fuckability to lovability, a feeling of belonging, like to feel unfuckable is to feel that you're out in the cold and will never be allowed inside." "Yes," she said. "So that's an attachment wound," I said, referring to the panic grief space. "My dad left when I was little," she affirmed. "So this wound when you were little met a culture that said the way to be safe from abandonment was to be sexually desirable, and that culture was also saying that I wasn't that," she finished. "Yes." This is just one example of the ways our imperfect childhoods become toxic when, at adolescence, or sooner, they meet a culture of sexual imperatives. These imperatives define not just who gets to be sexual, but how sex should happen. In Mediated Intimacy, Sex Advice in Media Culture, Meg John Barker, Rosalind Gill, and Laura Harvey document the ubiquitous imperatives in sex advice in mainstream media like women's magazines and TV shows. Do any of these sound familiar? The coital imperative to have penis in vagina sex, since heterosexuality is just assumed. The variety imperative to have manual, oral, and anal play in addition to penis in vagina sex. The performance imperative to enhance your sexual skill set, like an ambitious employee pursuing a promotion, to work on and discipline the body and make time to work at sex. And more, the confidence imperative The pleasure imperative, the imperative to have a relationship because sex is better within an intimate relationship, and the sex imperative itself to be a sexual person who wants and has and even likes sex. To this list, I want to add the monogamy imperative because you should only have one sexual relationship at a time. And the desire imperative, which I described in Chapter 2, the imperative to experience spontaneous desire on a regular basis, regardless of the context. We can also list any number of body imperatives, what my friend would describe as the fuckability imperative, to conform as closely as you can to a culturally constructed and highly gendered aesthetic ideal, and to work relentlessly to discipline your body, never to accept your body as it is. Where do we get these ideas about the sex imperatives? From everywhere. They're in explicit sex advice, sure, but also in movies and TV, in porn, and even what our friends are willing to talk about. People read romance novels and erotica as scripts, or even self-help for improving their sex lives. Could the wild popularity of the 50 Shades phenomenon be partly explained because women read it as a potential script to access the sexual satisfaction they'd been missing? Some people certainly did. A therapist at a workshop I led said she was working with a couple who treated 50 Shades as a textbook. And she was conflicted because it seemed to her that, quote, BDSM seems inherently abusive, end quote. Particularly worrying to me was that even the therapist thought 50 Shades was an accurate representation of BDSM, and therefore she thought BDSM was inevitably coercive. Anyone in the BDSM community will be relieved to know that my answer was, oh golly no, no, 50 Shades is not BDSM. There are so many other, better books they could be reading. The imperatives are sometimes incredibly specific in their ideas about what happens during sex. For example, a straight couple were engaged but wanted to solve a sexual difficulty before they fully committed to marriage, so they went to therapy. The problem was he wanted her to swallow his ejaculate when she went down on him, and she did not want to swallow. They used an approach like the approach in Chapter 1. What did he want when he wanted her to swallow? What did she not want when she didn't want to swallow? He wanted to feel fully accepted, he said, to have the experience of a blowjob that didn't end with her mouth leaving his penis, but staying through the entire process. And she didn't like how her digestion felt afterward, for one thing. Also, she did not want to feel pressured to do something she didn't like. Solution? How might they feel about him ejaculating in her mouth, but her not swallowing? Just leave it there on his genitals afterward, or maybe even kiss him and transfer the ejaculate to his mouth to swallow, sometimes called snowballing. Yep, that got them both what they wanted and avoided the things they didn't want. He wasn't interested in having his own ejaculate in his mouth, but he was on board with ejaculating in her mouth and her not swallowing. I learned of this couple through their therapist, a marriage and family therapist, not a sex therapist. When I suggested to her that the couple talk through the pros and cons and maybe find a compromise like this one, the therapist told me it had never occurred to either client or even to her that someone could allow a partner to ejaculate into their mouth and then not swallow. Sometimes when I tell this story, people can't understand how neither the therapist nor either partner had never heard of spit or swallow. This shows how much people can vary in the sexual imperatives they've absorbed from the culture. Sometimes people's unspoken, subconscious sex imperatives make it difficult for me to even understand their questions. At a workshop in a sex toy store, an attendee had to rephrase their question 3 times before I realized they were assuming that anal play always meant penetration. When I finally caught on, I said, oh, I see. Yeah, no, when I say anal play, I'm talking about any and all anal play, and most of that is external. You don't have to push your tongue into your partner's anus in order to do analingus. You can just kiss or lick around the external part of the sphincter and perineum. And when you touch with your fingers, again, no penetration needs to be involved. Though, still definitely try adding lube to your fingers, even for external touch. Oh, said the workshop attendee. And then we talked about managing involuntary tension of the anal sphincter. The tools from part one, especially calm, warm curiosity, and the adjusted definitions of normal and perfect, are intended to help you address situations when a sex imperative shows up in your sex life and you decide to address it directly. But the challenge with unspoken assumptions is that they're unspoken. You may not even realize they're there, the way the couple in therapy didn't realize they were assuming that if someone ejaculates in your mouth, your only option is to swallow it. The workshop attendee didn't notice that they were assuming if they agreed to anal play, they were agreeing to anal penetration. You always have another option, to swallow or not, to kiss or not, to orgasm or not, to keep going or to stop, to ask your partner to change something or to let them keep doing what they're doing. You can use words to express what you want and like. You can use nonverbal vocalization. You can use body language. You get to choose. Amma and Dai. My friends, do not always take my advice. No matter how often I said, other people's sex lives have nothing to do with yours, Dai wanted to know how often a typical couple has sex according to the research. Her reason? Dai was haunted by the idea of lesbian bed death. Lesbian bed death is the idea that sex eventually evaporates in long-term sexual relationships between women. And look, it just doesn't. I mean, it may have in your personal experience, just as it may in any relationship, but lesbians are not more likely to experience bed death than anyone else. But Dai looked up the average frequency of sex, the measure of central tendency that doesn't mean anything useful, and inevitably, reflexively, compared their sex life to that completely irrelevant number, and she was suddenly really worried that they were doing it wrong. What I love about this story is that simple facts went a long way in solving the problem. This is a rare circumstance that I cherish in my nerdy heart. I didn't quite assemble a PowerPoint presentation about the research, but I did announce to them that I would like, in the words of lesbian sex therapist Suzanne Iacenza, to put this myth to bed. I gave them this summary of what's actually true about sex in long-term lesbian relationships. Lesbian partners are more likely to report having sex less frequently as the relationship goes on, or possibly at every stage of the relationship. But they also report having very similar levels of sexual satisfaction as straight couples who are having more frequent sex. More variety of sexual behaviors, including oral sex and using sex toys. Longer duration of sex. More orgasms and more gentle kissing. They're also more likely to say, I love you. When you look beyond frequency, generally speaking, lesbians have better sex than straight couples. They're more likely to have orgasms. Sex lasts longer, like twice as long. And they're generally more satisfied. Why? Because when they don't worry about patriarchal, penis-centric models of sexuality, they can love their sexuality as it is without judging themselves against an irrelevant standard. Does that sound like bed death to you? I concluded. Saying I love you through a kiss while you press a vibrator against your partner's genitals, watching her come as you've watched her come and she has watched you for the last umpteen years? Amma and I were silent, but their eyes said, nope. I continued, changing mental slides to the patriarchy of it all. The idea of sexual frequency as a measure of bed depth exists only because of the sex imperative, the cis-heteropatriarchal standards set by cisgender men on everyone. It fails to account for duration of sex, pleasure, connection, orgasm, or even basic satisfaction. It ignores everything that happens outside sexy times, erasing all the moments of eroticism, connection, pleasure, and affection throughout the day. In short, it's a problem that exists only when you accept the sex imperatives. So if your frequency of sexy times has dropped, before you label it bed death, notice how much aliveness does exist. If you weren't judging your frequency against some fictional standard of how often is often enough, how satisfied would you be with the quality of your erotic connection? And if you want to increase the erotic aliveness in your relationship, what apart from intimacy would increase that aliveness? Even if you're not a lesbian, I encourage you to ask yourself these same questions. Amma tapped Dai on the arm. See? She's right. We already know teasing and play. We already have buckets of orgasms. The main thing that's missing is just time. And Emily cannot get us more of that. I'm sure there are scientists working on it, but no, I said. They fed me dessert as a thank you for the science. The next time I saw Di, I discovered I had sparked her curiosity. She came to me with a history lesson. Here's what she taught me. The term lesbian bed death was not born of a misogynist patriarchal narrative. It originated in the early 1980s, toward the end of the feminist sex wars, a conflict among second-wave feminists who came to be identified as either anti-porn or sex-positive. Dai said, this is a big part of the origin of the 2020s tension between trans-inclusive feminists and the other people, the ones who believe that cisgender women's comfort and convenience matter more than the safety and lives of transgender women, and that trans men aren't. But, she continued, the good part is that in the sex-positive or pro-sex rhetoric, lesbian bed death referred not merely to low or no frequency sex in lesbian relationships, but to the shrinkage of social space for public and communal discussion of sexuality within the women's movement. Her voice took on a lyrical quality I associate with her explaining her master's thesis. As a description of a historical moment, this term resonates not as a death knell of frequent sex between lesbian partners, but as the toll of puritanical, patriarchal sex norms on women's pursuit of shared, embodied liberation. In short, the idea of lesbian bed death, as the term is used in the 21st century, is yet another way to dismiss women's sexuality as inferior to men's. I'm surprised I fell for that misogynist binary trash. But empirically and historically, I now know better and I will do better. I love that, I told her. Can we keep the idea that women and femmes of all varieties deserve public and communal, shame-free, judgment-free discussion of sexuality that centers their experiences without reference to cis-heteropatriarchal standards? And yeah, I really do talk like that in real life, but so does Di. She raised her water glass. Long may we center, value, and learn from the erotic and sexual lives of women and femmes who enjoy sex with each other. Confidence is knowing what's true. And joy is loving what's true. With a deeper understanding of both the science and the cultural history, Amma and Di understood not only how to center pleasure, but why centering pleasure is part of how they make the world a better place. Their pleasure means something powerful in a world that still, how can it be, still tries to legislate LGBTQIA2+ people out of public life. Footnote. In the time it took me to write this book, hundreds of anti-trans bills were introduced in state legislatures. 63 progressed in the legislature. 73 failed and 98 passed, with more passing each year, 20 in 2021, 29 in 2022, 49, as of the writing in late May of 2023. See tracktranslegislation.com for more. The pretty imperatives. In the same way I wish I could write a sex advice book without talking about trauma, I wish I could write a book without addressing body image. But here we are, once more talking about the Bikini Industrial Complex, or BIC. That's my sister's name for the giant corporate money machine that profits from your self-loathing. So it lies to you to make sure you believe that you are not merely unlovely and unlovable, but also unhealthy and immoral, slothful and greedy, if your body doesn't conform to the ideal body it says you should have. As an imperative, to go along with the sex imperatives and the desire imperative, I think of it as the pretty imperative. The reality is your body is lovable right now, and your health can't be measured on a scale. You were lied to. And the changes we experience with age are a fascinating prize we win for being lucky enough to grow older. Black listeners literally do not need me to tell them this, as Tracy Gilbert wrote in her book, Black and Sexy, A Framework of Racialized Sexuality, many African Americans, quote, appeared well aware of the expectations presented by mainstream society to reject black femininity and black beauty, choosing instead to value them anyway. And in their own way, this particular act of resistance, choosing one's self when there is no external incentive to do so, serves as a source and mechanism of sexiness development in and of itself. End quote. In a way, the BIC is mostly an external negative influence for marginalized people, while it's more of an internal negative influence for white people, able-bodied people, thin people, and others who seem to be so tantalizingly close to meeting the ideal that they can't help believing that goal is attainable. People of color, along with visibly disabled people, people of size, and other marginalized folks, already know that they will never meet the BIC's standard for the aesthetic ideal. But the closer you are, the more hope you have that maybe one day you could be beautiful enough to deserve to be treated as a complete human. The closer you are, the less likely you may be to believe me when I say your body doesn't have to be perfect to be lovable. But let's get right to some solutions. First, can you simply be curious about your body? Body image issues are rage toward your own body, an urge to destroy. Obviously, the urge to make your body not exist isn't compatible with the urge to experience erotic delights. Another space from which we might relate to our bodies is fear, turning away from them, avoiding, pretending they don't exist. In Come As You Are, I recommended a practical way to experiment with shifting from rage or fear to seeking. In the mirror exercise, you stand naked in front of a mirror, look at what you see there, and write down everything you see that you like. Do this over and over again, and gradually you build up immunity against the Bikini Industrial Complex. You learn over and over that you are already deserving of joy and love and kindness because there is nothing your body can do to disqualify it from those pleasures. In other words, hello, body. I literally see you. I love you. I want to know you. In Burnout, Amelia and I recommend mess acceptance, recognizing that we can work hard to embrace our bodies exactly as they are, while the BIC continues to punish us for daring to try to love ourselves. Hello, mess. I see you. I love you. I want to know you. I want you to know that you are allowed to like your body. And I know a lot of us struggle with that every day. We will always be working to love ourselves in the midst of a culture that tells us not to. So I also want you to know that it's enough just to turn with calm, warm curiosity toward your body and toward the critical messages you've internalized. Turning toward your own body with neutral to warm curiosity may mean turning away from those who would encourage you to conform to an ideal rather than embrace yourself as you are. As a child of immigrants, trauma therapist Sonali Rashatwar's experience with a fat-phobic culture included pressure from their parents to lose weight, even to have weight loss surgery, a pressure, quote, rooted in love and a desire to assimilate, end quote. So often, the pressure to change our bodies to match the cultural ideal grows out of our love for others, our desire to please them, and out of their desire for us to be safe from the very real and very dangerous stigma against bodies that violate the cultural standard. As they wrote in 2020, quote, in the body image workshops I run as a trauma therapist, I teach the concept of understanding our bodies as heirlooms. If we think about the purpose of an heirloom, it's a symbolic representation of resilience. We do not criticize an heirloom. We do not devalue it for its flaws and imperfections. We see heirlooms as tangible evidence of the existence of our ancestors. I want fat folks of color to see our bodies as essential and necessary in the context of survival. I want us to remember to write ourselves into existence at the expense of diet culture and fat phobia. End quote. Hello, heirloom. I see you. I love you. I want to know you. In Japanese culture, wabi-sabi is a way of knowing the world that embraces impermanence, incorporating flaws and signs of age or wear into the perception of beauty. The widely discussed African ethic of Ubuntu is generally translated into English as I am because we are. It locates beauty not within an individual, but within community, within relationship. Neither wabi-sabi nor Ubuntu exist to understand the beauty of our bodies, but both create a potential context for understanding our bodies, our own and others, more humanely and compassionately than the context of the BIC. I don't think it's a coincidence that language that makes space for beauty beyond the bikini industrial complex is found only in cultures outside my own white American culture. The closest I can find to a Western conception of beauty beyond the BIC is jolie laide, a French language term that translated literally means pretty ugly. These days, it's generally used to mean something like unconventionally attractive. Unfortunately, an internet image search for the term surfaces almost exclusively photos of ultra-thin, cisgender white women whose facial features are stunning but not symmetrical with mathematical precision. It highlights just how narrow is the range of conventional beauty. I genuinely believe that every body is beautiful because beauty is innate in every body, just as it's innate in every flower, every bird, every rock, and every river. But I know from long experience that many more people struggle to internalize this truth than I would ever expect. If I met you, I would probably be delighted with the beauty and kindness you bring to our interaction, and then I would be stunned to realize that you too carry around a vicious voice in your head that tells you you don't deserve pleasure and love. A voice just like the one I carry around. I'm not saying beautiful is something you should be. I'm saying beautiful is something you can't help being because all bodies are already beautiful. Period. human beauty isn't the same thing as the culturally constructed, aspirational aesthetic ideal. Human beauty is having any human body. An antidote to the imperatives. Blanket permission. Since I can't anticipate every single detail of what the shoulds or should nots of the sex imperatives in your garden say ought to happen during sex, let me offer blanket permission. My only rules are, as I have said, that everyone involved is glad to be there and free to leave with no unwanted consequences, and there's no unwanted pain. You can allow a partner to ejaculate into your mouth, or not. And you can choose whether to swallow or not. You and a partner can choose whether to kiss with the ejaculate between your mouths or not. You can choose to put a penis in your mouth in the first place or not. You can just use your hands. You can just use your mouth and use your hands for something else, like touching another part of your partner's body, or touching somewhere on your own body, or gripping the sheets, or just knitting, if that's what you're into. Careful with the needles. And if there's something you think you should be doing, but it hits your brakes, you do not have to do it. You can do something else. Anything else. You can burst into song if you want to. You can over-explain the plot of your favorite movie. You always get to choose. More blanket permission. Orgasms take as long as they take, and they are only as important as you decide they are. If a person's body has a clitoris and a vagina, they're much more likely to orgasm from clitoral stimulation than vaginal stimulation, but they also might be orgasmic from many other kinds of stimulation: breast or chest stimulation, earlobe stimulation, foot stimulation, back of the knee or inside of the elbow stimulation, or fantasy alone, or none of these. Some people never have orgasms and never really want to, despite the pressure they feel from other people to keep trying. People vary. You are not doing it wrong. If you want to have an orgasm and haven't yet, there are books about just that. You also have permission to try sex toys with or without your partner. They do not replace a partner in any way, but they can be an adjunct. When people tell me they feel threatened or intimidated or insecure around their partner's sex toy, I ask if they feel that way about a partner's car, bus, train, bicycle, or whatever mode of transportation they use to get places. That vehicle does things you cannot do, but you can do a whole lot of things that vehicle will never do. Try going along for the ride. While I'm on the subject, no, you can't get addicted to a sex toy, though you can get spoiled in a way. For example, if you have orgasms much faster when you use a vibrator, that speed might reset your expectation about how long it should take to have an orgasm, which might mean that when you try to have an orgasm without the toy, maybe you begin to feel frustrated that it's taking so long, when in fact it's just taking as long as it always takes without a vibrator. If you start getting frustrated, is that going to make it easier to orgasm? Or is it going to hit the brakes and slow you down? Right, brakes. Even more permission. If you want to do erotic things that do not include any genital touching, you can do that. If you want to use lube, not just on the genitals, but all over everyone's body so that everything anyone touches is slick and slippery, as long as everyone involved is glad to do that, go for it. If you want your partner to gently bite your labia, you can ask for that. If you want to thrust your tongue into your partner's ear, you can ask for that. If you want to fuck your partner's armpit and your partner is glad for you to do that, fuck your partner's armpit. It's called axillary intercourse. Letting go of other people's judgments. A lot of sex books talk about letting go of fear of other people's judgments. The usual advice is to remember that people really aren't thinking about you that much. They're too absorbed in their own lives to notice the things you worry they'll judge. That is correct, and it is good advice. But I think it ignores an important dynamic. I've found that the people who are most worried about other people's judgments are also very busy monitoring and judging other people. Who gained weight? Who didn't wear makeup to work? Whose clothes aren't the right clothes? Which couple is clinging to each other at the party? Which couple spent time in different social groups? Which couple bickered? If you find yourself thinking a lot about other people's appearances and behaviors and whether they're doing it right, chances are you also think a lot about your own appearance and behaviors and whether you're doing it right. Your judgment of others and your worry about yourself are both born of the underlying belief that there is a right way and a wrong way to be, and we are all supposed to do whatever it takes to be right, no matter how unnatural it feels, no matter how much it hurts. After all, you torture yourself to make sure your body and face and behavior are correct. And if you can or must do it, so can or must anyone and everyone else. To let go of fear of other people's judgments of you, let go first of your judgments of yourself and others. Be who you truly are, and be compassionate toward yourself for the ways you don't match the imperatives you've been measuring yourself against. Admire others for who they truly are, especially the ways their true self doesn't match those imperatives. You belong in the human community. You are allowed to be you, and other people are allowed to be themselves. And you'll find that as you replace your harsh self-criticism and body discipline with self-compassion and self-forgiveness, your need to judge others will evaporate, along with your fear of their judgment. Blanket permission for new-ish parents. For those who bring young, dependent humans into their lives, the imperatives become entirely implausible and have to be replaced with brand new, wholly individual ways of experiencing erotic connection. Of course they do. The meanings of your individual life, your shared life, your bodies, and your identities all change radically and permanently. Everyone who has become a parent knows this. And yet, somehow, many, many parents are unprepared for the truly radical changes that happen to their bodies, their relationship, and to their sexual connection. I get asked more, "How am I supposed to?" questions from new parents than from anyone else. And the answer is always, you are not. You're not supposed to do anything but your best, which is hard enough without added pressure to do what you're supposed to. How am I supposed to meet the needs of my child, my employer, my partner, and all the other people in my life and stay sane? You are not. You are supposed to do your best, and your best will nearly always fall short of the vast, infinite, sucking vortex of what the world needs from you. How am I supposed to feel sexy when my nipples are cracked and bleeding, or I haven't slept more than 3 hours in a row for most of a year, or I am extremely touched out from toddler hands on me, or the sight of my partner fills me with an unfathomable rage? You are not. You're not supposed to. You know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to collaborate with your partner to co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. And that is going to be very, very difficult during this time when your life is changing rapidly, continuously, and uncontrollably. It's normal for the pleasure project to drop lower on your list of priorities. But here's what I've found, both in listening to parents talk about their struggles and in learning about their solutions. I think you miss each other. Even when you're furious with each other, a part of you wants to find a way through all the emotion and exhaustion and existential terror to a place of adult human connection. Parenting can be excruciatingly lonely, a bitter irony considering one of the first things you lose when you add children to your family is time alone. Time with your child is many things, but it is not the same as time with a friend or time on your own, both of which are basic human needs. Finding moments to feel attuned to a fellow adult is deeply nourishing, and sexual connection is a powerful way to get that. You want tips? I've got 5 for you. But none of them will help you if you use them with the goal of doing what you're supposed to, rather than a goal of finding your way back, even if only for a few minutes, to a partner you admire and trust. Here are your tips. 1. Schedule a regular time to connect, even if you don't end up having sex. You can pay attention to your emotional floor plans and notice how each person can help the other get to spaces adjacent to lust to increase the likelihood that sex might happen, but expectations and obligations mostly just hit the brakes. It helps to have a sense of humor about the struggles of finding time to be adults together while taking care of kids, but go ahead and have big fights if that's what it takes to help you clarify your needs to each other. 2. Center pleasure. Your shared task is to co-create a context that makes it easier to access pleasure, not arousal, horniness, orgasms, or desire. If you have sex you don't enjoy, maybe so you can say you had sex or cross something off the to-do list, the next time an opportunity arises, your brain will remember, hey, last time was no fun, and it'll be even more difficult to show up for the party. 3. There are no rules but consent. If one of you wants to connect sexually and the other partner is feeling exhausted but affectionate, maybe the less interested, sleep-deprived partner can be entirely lazy, lying beside their partner and watching them masturbate like they're watching TV, for fun, for amusement, for relaxation, for distraction. 4. Overnights and weekends away, to change the context. Narratives of parents who stay erotically connected very often include intentional time away from parenting. It's easier when, say, a family member can come stay with the kids while you get away. The context is thoroughly changed without you having to do a lot of work. But maybe it's easier if the kids spend the night with their aunt and you stay home. At home, take the first couple of hours to create a bubble of grown-up fun. In the Come As You Are workbook, I call it the magic circle. Decorate with lights or candles. Add a gorgeous scent to the air. Definitely get all the kid toys out of the bedroom. Change the sheets. Finish the dishes and the laundry and clean the bathtub in case you want to play in the water. What an opportunity to give great chore play. Maybe all you'll do with your time together is sleep for 12 hours, but that alone is nourishing for your bodies and your relationship. 5. Finally, when in doubt, go back to the beginning. What is it that I want when I want sex? What is it that I like? What activates my accelerator and what hits my brakes? Your answers are probably changing as your household, relationship, bodies, and internal experiences change. Keep talking to each other. If you can talk about another human's bodily fluids, you can talk to each other about your sex life. Now is your moment. The old rules, the sex imperatives, never actually applied to your sex life, and the transformation that comes with adding children to your relationship is an excellent opportunity to dump all that old garbage and start from scratch. You get to play a whole new game with a new set of rules that you invent. Precisely what the rules are and how you play by them will vary from relationship to relationship and from season to season, as the tiny humans in your life grow and develop. Bonus tip, your bodies are permanently different whether you're a birthing parent or not. Don't waste time and energy trying to get your body back. You still have your body. It never left you. Instead, spend that time and energy learning about your body as it is now. None of the rules about how bodies should be ever applied to you, but now they are distracting irrelevancies that prevent you from noticing that your body is a frickin' frackin' miracle that is helping to keep other young humans alive. Your body is glorious. Care for it as you're caring for your tiny humans. Listen to your body. Move it in ways that manage stress. Stay connected in loving, trusting relationships with other adults. Eat food that nourishes you, body and soul, and get every second of rest you can. Another antidote to the sex imperatives. Play a new game. The rigidity and urgency of the sex imperatives set the stakes of sexual difficulties so high, you might even wonder if you, your partner, or your relationship are doomed. Hey, remember which space in the emotional floor plan lowers the stakes? Play. In their essay, The Pieces of the Puzzle, gender therapist Fitz offers a metaphor of sexuality as a jigsaw puzzle. When you start the puzzle, they say, you begin organizing the pieces based on shape, edge or center, color, text, texture, etc., and you rely on the picture on the box to tell you what the puzzle is supposed to look like in the end. But what if the puzzle just came in a bag, with no picture to guide you? You don't even know for sure that all these pieces are from the same puzzle. Let the unknowns introduced by this bag of puzzle pieces spark curiosity, rather than fear that the pieces won't fit, or you'll somehow do it wrong. They conclude, quote, I like to think of it as a gradual collection of puzzle pieces. Collect the ones that fit. Set aside the ones that don't. Over time, you'll see ways they fit together and make sense to you. You don't have to know the whole picture in order to recognize pieces you like and enjoy the experience. End quote. This brings me to the next antidote to the imperatives. Play a new game. To begin, it might help to invent a name for something you want to try, like with axillary, armpit, intercourse. I've learned that people feel normalized when they find out there's a term for something. Once, after a workshop, a woman approached me and said, I know you're going to say this is normal, but I just have to ask. What my partner really likes is when he presses the soles of his feet together and I lick into the space between his arches. Is that? Sure, totally normal, I said. I described a little about how even though our feet are pretty far from our genitals, in our brains, they're right next to each other, so lots of people enjoy foot sensations. And because I have a passing familiarity with the sort of Latin roots used to invent medical terms, I added, let's call it interplantar linctus. And you can try it too, if you're interested. Try giving a name to whatever you and your partners are curious to try. You've just given a name to the new game you're going to play together. If you aren't sure what new game you want to play, but you'd like to reveal some unspoken imperatives in your erotic mind, try a stop-start game. These kinds of games ask you to share pleasure and touch without urgency or expectation of performance. All you have to do is stop doing any sexual behavior at a random moment during sex and engage in some other sexual behavior. Don't follow the script of what order you're supposed to go in or when you're supposed to transition to something new. If it helps you break the rules, you can make it like a game of Simon Says. Partner A, Simon Says stop sucking. Partner B stops with a frustrated but amused grunt. Partner A, Simon Says suck, but very, very gently. Or partner A, stop thrusting. Partner B stops with a frustrated, amused grunt. Partner A, teasing, I didn't say Simon Says. Not comfortable inviting Simon into your sex life? Make it Simone, or switch to Mother May I, using whatever term of endearment feels better than mother, like honey, darling, lover May I, or your partner's name. Or use mother, do you. Another game you can play? I call it Where Lick. Ask yourself, what part of my partner's body have I never licked? Under what circumstances might we both be interested in the experience of me licking the unlicked part? Talk about it. Create a sex-positive context and give it a try. Or you might try a version of sensate focus therapy, which progresses in stages over a number of weeks. For example, first partner A touches partner B, excluding body parts that underwear covers. Partner A's job is to touch for their own pleasure, while partner B's job is to speak up if something feels uncomfortable. And then they switch roles. Next, partner A touches partner B, still excluding body parts that underwear covers, for both partners' pleasure. The touchee speaks up both when something feels uncomfortable and when something feels especially good. And then they switch. Then A touches B, including the body parts underwear covers, for both partners' pleasure, with all the mutual communication of the previous stage. And then they switch. At last, partners A and B touch simultaneously for mutual pleasure. The imperatives often bubble to the surface when people explore in this more systematic way. Be ready to talk about them as they emerge, either in the moment or some other time when you're not in the middle of the experience. Another game that can allow the imperatives to bubble up so that you can discard them is to play within the structure of the peripheral nervous system. Choose an area of your body or a partner's and explore it with attention to one type of sensory input at a time. Here are just a few of the different ways that human skin can experience sensation. Light touch, feather-soft touches that brush over the skin. Deep touch, pressure touch that presses down through the skin to the muscle below. Texture. Try different textures, from sleek silk to rough stubble, from suede to silicone. Temperature. Stay in a gentle range at first, of course. You're not trying to burn your partner or give them frostbite, but an ice cube moved over the surface of the skin will activate those temperature-sensitive nerve endings. Movement and stillness. Sensations can be fleeting, as a hand moving over and away from the surface it's stroking, or they can sustain, as a hand resting on a surface. How does touching your partner feel in your body when you stay still and keep your touch the same for several seconds or more? Stretch. Skin stretch, joint and muscle stretch, connective tissue stretch. Hair follicle displacement. Can you touch your partner so lightly that you move the hairs on their body without touching their skin? Follicles have nerve endings that sense when a hair is being moved. Don't forget what we learned in Chapter 2, that our perception of a sensation varies depending on the context. How is it with the lights on or off? At home or on vacation? In the afternoon or at midnight? For more ideas about new games you can play, try the various card packs, dice games like the couple in Chapter 3, and books with titles like 101 Fun New Party Tricks for Sexy Times. All make for fun inspiration as long as you engage with them without urgency, with nothing at stake, and with no sense that there is a right or wrong way to play these games. In their book Gender Magic, gender and sex therapist Ray McDaniel tells the story of watching a friend garbed in an inflatable dinosaur costume, masturbating to orgasm in front of a delighted audience at a play party. You really are allowed to break every rule. It really is supposed to be fun. In Chapter 2, I described pleasure as a shy animal. When you play a new game, You're crafting rules to coax the animal into a carefree romp. The only universal rule with all these games is everyone involved is glad to be there and free to leave with no unwanted consequences. With each game you play, you collect more pieces in the puzzle of your own, your partner's, and your relationship's sexual pleasures. If you have been listening with a sense of urgency, feeling that your relationship is at stake because of sexual difficulties, take a breath. If you've felt that the tools and mindsets from part one seemed impossible, take a step back. The sex imperatives have taken up residence in your emotional floor plan, and it might be time to declutter them. No sexual difficulty is worth destroying an otherwise strong relationship. Are you showing up for each other with admiration and trust? Are you turning toward your sexuality as it is right now with confidence, joy, and curiosity? Then you're already doing it right, regardless of the outcome or timeline. What's truly necessary is for you to recognize the lies you've been told and to make choices about whether to believe them or not. Do you have to follow the sex imperatives? Does your body have to be disciplined into conforming with the bikini industrial complex's idea of a body worthy of pleasure? Or are you allowed to play with your partner according to whatever rules feel right for you? You get to choose. Chapter 9, TLDR. 1. The coital imperative, variety imperative, performance imperative, confidence imperative, pleasure imperative, relationship imperative, the desire imperative, and even the sex imperative itself, to be a sexual person who wants, has, and likes sex, could all be creating a needless sense of urgency for you to work on your sex life to make it more like it's supposed to be. 2. You are already beautiful, because beautiful is something you can't help being, just as a tree can't help being beautiful, and a dog can't help it, and a river can't help it. You couldn't be less than beautiful if you tried. 3. To stop the impact of the sex imperatives, try playing new games by different rules that ask you to share pleasure and touch in ways that have nothing to do with any urgent need to be or do sex differently. Some good questions. Which sex imperatives are explicitly present in my brain? Which might be implicit, unspoken, yet still obstructing my access to my full erotic self? What would it take for me to look at my body in the mirror and see that I am already beautiful, as every tree is already beautiful in all seasons? What kind of game might we try to play by new rules instead of allowing the unspoken imperatives to tell us how to live our erotic lives?